From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
After September the 11th, I made a commitment to the American people. This nation will not wait to be attacked again. We will defend our freedom. We will take the fight to the enemy. Iraq is the latest battlefield in this war.
Watching the president's speech, it really seems as if he's stuck in a time warp of some kind. The continued references to 9/11, totally unrelated to the invasion and occupation of Iraq, is one thing. And he insists, no, we're not going to withdraw troops. We're not going to add more troops. The speech was about what we're going to do about Iraq, what we're going to do in Iraq, and he provided none of that.
Today, a roundtable discussion with former Pentagon insider Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski, Middle East journalist Robert Fisk, and Cindy Sheehan. She lost her son in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a primetime address to the nation, President Bush defended the war in Iraq and rejected calls to set a deadline for withdrawing U.S. troops. Bush spoke from Fort Bragg at a time that domestic support for the war has reached an all-time low.
Amid all this violence, I know Americans ask the question, is the sacrifice worth it? It is worth it, and it is vital to the future security of our country.
President Bush repeatedly tied the war in Iraq to September 11th, even though Iraq had no role in the attacks. Bush used the word terror or terrorism 34 times and mentioned September 11th 5 times.
They are trying to shake our will in Iraq, just as they tried to shake our will on September the 11th, 2001. They will fail.
Democrats widely criticized the speech. Speaking on CNN, Senator John Kerry accused Bush of creating a third rationale for going to war. Kerry said, quote, the first, of course, was weapons of mass destruction. The second was democracy. And now tonight, it's combat, to combat the hotbed of terrorism. Kerry went on to say, quote, but most Americans are aware that the hotbed of terrorism never existed in Iraq until we got there, and it has, in fact, grown increasingly as we are there, he said. Meanwhile, a new Gallup poll shows 45% of Americans now believe the U.S. will never succeed in Iraq. While Bush's speech focused solely on Iraq, it came just hours after the U.S. suffered what appears to be one of its biggest losses in Afghanistan since the U.S. invaded in 2001. A U.S. CH-47 military helicopter with 17 service members on board crashed in eastern Afghanistan. Military officials say it was likely shot down. The fate of the service members is unknown. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. In Iraq, U.S. troops have killed as many as 3 Iraqi journalists over the past week. Reporters Without Borders have called for an investigation into the shooting death of the program director for Al-Sharqiya Television. He was shot dead Tuesday while driving near a U.S. convoy. On Sunday, a news editor with a local Baghdad TV channel was shot dead by U.S. troops in the capital. And on Friday, an Iraqi reporter working for an American news organization was shot and killed in Baghdad, allegedly by U.S. troops. The U.S. military has not confirmed any of the killings. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, at least 45 journalists and 20 media support workers have been killed while covering the war in Iraq. Meanwhile, Tuesday, Iraqi police opened fire on a group of 2,000 demonstrators in the town of Samawa. One man was shot in the head. 7 others were wounded. The demonstration was organized by unemployed workers. Some of the protesters threw rocks at the police. An Italian court official has said Italy is preparing to request the extradition of 13 CIA officers accused of kidnapping the Muslim cleric from the streets of Milan 3 years ago. Prosecutors also have asked the help of Interpol in tracking down the suspects, all identified as U.S. citizens. One of the suspects named was Robert Selden Lady, the former CIA station chief in Milan. The BBC is reporting Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. has resigned after serving the post for over 2 decades. Prince Bandar bin Sultan was well-known in Washington and had close ties to the White House. Because of his ties with the Bush family, he earned the nickname Bandar Bush. President Bush met with him 2 days after the September 11th attacks, even though 15 of the 19 hijackers had come from Saudi Arabia. Bandar is expected to now seek a high-ranking position back home, possibly as head of Saudi intelligence. NBC News is reporting the Bush administration raised the terror alert level 2 years ago after CIA analysts mistakenly believed they saw coded messages on the Arabic television channel Al Jazeera. The CIA agents thought they had decoded a message that indicated attacks were planned on the White House, the Space Needle in Seattle, and a small town in Virginia called Tappahannock. Population 2,000. In response, the Department of Homeland Security increased the threat level from yellow to orange. Several international flights were canceled. Seven men with Arab-sounding names were detained and questioned in Paris. This news from East Timor. A new report from the United Nations says an international tribunal may be needed in order to prosecute those behind atrocities carried out in 1999 during Timor's referendum on independence. At least 1,400 people were killed by militias working with Indonesian security forces. The UN report concludes that not enough has been done to prosecute the killers. The report has not yet been released, but a copy was obtained by the BBC. Meanwhile, in Washington, the House of Representatives voted last night to lift all restrictions on military assistance for Indonesia in next year's Foreign Operations Appropriations Bill. East Timor and Indonesia Action Network condemned the vote. The group's Washington coordinator, Karen Ornstein, said, quote, "This is a grave setback which turns a blind eye to the ongoing violations and horrific record of the Indonesian military." The Canadian government is on the verge of becoming only the third nation in the world to legalize same-sex marriage. Legislators voted to approve the new law Tuesday. One member of Prime Minister Paul Martin's cabinet resigned his post in protest over the vote. Netherlands and Belgium have already legalized same-sex marriage. The Associated Press is reporting that the Labor Department kept secret for more than a year government-funded studies that could hinder the passage of CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. The studies had concluded that several of the countries involved in the trade negotiations have poor working conditions and have failed to protect workers' rights. The study's conclusions contrast with the administration's arguments that Central American countries have made enough progress on such issues to warrant a free trade deal with the U.S. The studies were conducted by an outside contractor, the International Labor Rights Fund. According to the AP, the Labor Department instructed the contractor to remove the reports from its website, ordered it to retrieve paper copies before they became public, banned release of new information from the reports, and even told the contractor that it couldn't discuss the studies with outsiders. The Labor Department said such moves were taken because the agency had concluded that the contractor had, quote, failed to meet the academic rigor expected. And Cuban leader Fidel Castro has flown to Venezuela on his first trip abroad since 2003. Castro met with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez at a summit to discuss creating a regional oil alliance that would help distribute fuel more cheaply to the Caribbean. Also attending the summit were leaders of Trinidad and Tobago, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, Dominica, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Chavez said, quote, "It's a historic summit. As a world power in oil, we are extending them a hand."
Just read your paper and you see just exactly what keeps worrying me. Yeah, you see the world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. My love for the world is like always. For the world is a part of me. That's why I'm so afraid of the progress that's been made toward eternity.
Ray Charles singing Danger Zone. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a primetime address to the nation, President Bush defended the war in Iraq and rejected calls to set a deadline for withdrawing U.S. troops. Last night, President Bush repeatedly tried to connect the war in Iraq to the attacks on September 11th, even though Iraq had no role in 9/11. The White House had titled his remarks, "A Discussion on the War on Terror, Not Iraq." The president used much of his speech to portray the resistance in Iraq and the perpetrators of 9/11 as the same. While there was no mention of the original rationale for the invasion, the claim that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, Bush mentioned September 11th 5 times in his address and used the word terror or terrorism 34 times. The president also made a rare reference to Osama bin Laden, quoting him as a reason for staying the course. Bush acknowledged no flaw in the administration's Iraq policy. He refused to set a deadline for the withdrawal of troops in Iraq, despite repeated calls by lawmakers, including an increasing number of Republicans, for the president to do so. He also argued against sending more troops, saying it would undermine U.S. strategy. Over 1,700 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq and many thousands more wounded. Bush's speech came 25 months after the invasion began at a time that domestic support for the war has reached an all-time low. The Washington Post writes, quote, increasingly restive White House advisors concluded a couple weeks ago Bush needed to use his bully pulpit to reclaim control of the political debate over Iraq. In the past few weeks, the Bush administration has given mixed messages on Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney said the insurgency is in its last throes, but Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned it could last up to 12 years. After some initial reluctance, all three major networks broadcast the speech, which the White House scheduled to mark the first anniversary of the so-called handover of sovereignty in Iraq. Since then, 948 U.S. soldiers have died, thousands of Iraqis have been killed. A total of 52 senior Iraqi government or religious figures have been assassinated, on average once a week. And the number of Iraqi military and police being killed each month has jumped by 50%. Bush delivered the speech from Fort Bragg before hundreds of U.S. troops. They stood at attention without applauding as Bush entered and refrained from clapping during most of the address. There was one round of applause in the middle of the speech, which was apparently sparked by a White House aide, this according to the Los Angeles Times. Today we spend the hour going through President Bush's speech. We host a roundtable discussion with a former Pentagon insider, a veteran Middle East journalist, and a mother who lost her son in Iraq. But first, we go to President Bush's opening remarks last night.
The troops here and across the world are fighting a global war on terror. The war reached our shores on September the 11th, 2001. The terrorists who attack us and the terrorists we face murder in the name of a totalitarian ideology that hates freedom, rejects tolerance, and despises all dissent. Their aim is to remake the Middle East in their own grim image of tyranny and oppression by toppling governments, by driving us out of the region, and by exporting terror. To achieve these aims, they have continued to kill in Madrid, Istanbul, Jakarta, Casablanca, Riyadh, Bali, and elsewhere. The terrorists believe that free societies are essentially corrupt and decadent, and with a few hard blows, they can force us to retreat. They are mistaken. After September the 11th, I made a commitment to the American people. This nation will not wait to be attacked again. We will defend our freedom. We will take the fight to the enemy. Iraq is the latest battlefield in this war. Many terrorists who kill innocent men, women, and children on the streets of Baghdad are followers of the same murderous ideology that took the lives of our citizens in New York, in Washington, and Pennsylvania. There is only one course of action against them: to defeat them abroad before they attack us at home. The commander in charge of coalition operations in Iraq, who is also senior commander at this base, General John Vines, put it well the other day. He said, "We either deal with terrorism and this extremism abroad, or we deal with it when it comes to us." Our mission in Iraq is clear. We're hunting down the terrorists. We're helping Iraqis build a free nation that is an ally in the war on terror. We're advancing freedom in the broader Middle East. We are removing a source of violence and instability. and laying the foundation of peace for our children and our grandchildren. The work in Iraq is difficult, and it is dangerous. Like most Americans, I see the images of violence and bloodshed. Every picture is horrifying, and the suffering is real. Amid all this violence, I know Americans ask the question, is the sacrifice worth it? It is worth it, and it is vital to the future security of our country. And tonight, I will explain the reasons why. Some of the violence you see in Iraq is being carried out by ruthless killers who are converging on Iraq to fight the advance of peace and freedom. Our military reports that we've killed or captured hundreds of foreign fighters in Iraq who've come from Saudi Arabia and Syria, Iran, Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, Libya, and others. They are making common cause with criminal elements, Iraqi insurgents, and remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime who want to restore the old order. They fight because they know that the survival of their hateful ideology is at stake. They know that as freedom takes root in Iraq, it will inspire millions across the Middle East to claim their liberty as well. And when the Middle East grows in democracy and prosperity and hope, the terrorists will lose their sponsors, lose their recruits, and lose their hopes for turning that region into a base for attacks on America and our allies around the world.
That was President Bush speaking at Fort Bragg yesterday. We're joined now on the telephone by Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kitowski. I recently met her in West Virginia, her home state. We talked about her time in the Pentagon, where she served in the Near East and South Asia unit the year before the invasion of Iraq. She served in the parent office of the Office of Special Plans under one of the chief neoconservatives, Douglas Feith. She joins us on the phone right now from her home in West Virginia. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, thanks.
It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about first your reaction to President Bush's address last night at Fort Bragg?
Well, a very frightening speech, very frightening, if any of it had been true. And so I was actually curious as to who he was addressing this speech to. I mean, there were so many things in there that just don't match with reality, whether it's the American strategy, why we're in Iraq, which was supposedly why he gave this address, to explain to the American people why this is worth it, and yet he didn't speak about any of those reasons.
Can you talk from your own experience in the Pentagon, in one of the, and talk about the office you worked in, about how 9/11 was connected to the invasion of Iraq, how they linked it?
Well, in real terms, in truthful, honest terms, there was no connection, and that was well known by the intelligence community, and the administration was advised repeatedly that there was no connection between 9/11 and anything that Saddam Hussein was doing and anything that that people in Iraq were doing. So we knew there's no connection. What I saw when I worked in the Pentagon, of course, and what the American people saw was repeated attempts by the administration and several of the media outlets that the administration favors and uses, mainstream media, unfortunately, promulgated this idea prior to the invasion that 9/11 was somehow connected to Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi people. Later, after we invaded, after we searched for weapons of mass destruction, after we did all these other things and searched for terrorists, we searched for bin Laden's people, there weren't any in Iraq until after we got there, after we destroyed the security infrastructure and took down the Ba'ath Party system. Then you do have terrorists in Iraq, but only afterwards. So it's very disingenuous for George Bush to, at this late date, after so much is known, to make this connection, to suggest this 9/11 connection, and to suggest that this is about American homeland security. This thing in Iraq has nothing to do with homeland security, unless it's to make it worse.
We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski, worked in the Pentagon under Douglas Feith. We're going to break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. We'll also be joined by Patrick Coburn of The Independent, just came out of Iraq, and we'll be speaking with Cindy Sheehan, who is the mother of a U.S. soldier who was killed in Iraq. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and NPR stations, on low-power FM stations, public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org. We're closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and our headlines are in Spanish on our website at democracynow.org. Well, last night at Fort Bragg, President Bush repeatedly tried to connect the war in Iraq with the attacks on September 11th. While there was no mention of the original rationale for the invasion, the claim that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, President Bush mentioned September 11th five times in the address, used the word terror or terrorism 34 times. This is an edited montage of President Bush's address last night.
The troops here and across the world are fighting a global war on terror. The war reached our shores on September the 11th, 2001. The terrorists who attack us and the terrorists we face, murder in the name of a totalitarian ideology that hates freedom, rejects tolerance, and despises all dissent. After September the 11th, I made a commitment to the American people. This nation will not wait to be attacked again. We will defend our freedom. We will take the fight to the enemy. The terrorists can kill the innocent, but they cannot stop the advance of freedom. The only way our enemies can succeed is if we forget the lessons of September the 11th. We're fighting against men with blind hatred and armed with lethal weapons who are capable of any atrocity. They wear no uniform. They respect no laws of warfare or morality. They take innocent lives to create chaos for the cameras. They are trying to shake our will in Iraq, just as they tried to shake our will on September the 11th, 2001. They will fail. After September the 11th, 2001, I told the American people that the road ahead would be difficult and that we would prevail. Well, it has been difficult, and we are prevailing. Our enemies are brutal, but they are no match for the United States of America, and they are no match for the men and women of the United States military. May God bless you all.
President Bush made at least five references to September 11th in his less than 30-minute speech last night at Fort Bragg, which was held on the year anniversary of the supposed handover of power by the U.S. occupation authority to an interim Iraq government last June in 2004. We're joined on the telephone now by Patrick Coburn, who wrote a very interesting piece in the Independent newspaper in London about what has happened in this past year in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrick Coburn.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about just the facts that you lay out in your piece of what has transpired this year?
Well, the most striking feature of the last year is that things have got progressively worse. Most of Iraq is really a bloody no man's land now. The transfer of power last a year ago to the interim Iraqi government, which was billed as a great turning point, turned out to be no such thing. It's one of a series of turning points that have been presented, such as the capture of Saddam Hussein, the transfer of power, the capture of Fallujah last year, the elections. And Iraqis have seen their lives get worse and worse over that period. And there's no reason that anything should get any better. Certainly, that's the way they look at it.
It was interesting to see last night Iyad Alawi interviewed on CNN. He was in Beirut, I believe it was. And he was asked, Wolf Blitzer asked him, do you feel safer today in Iraq than you did a year ago? He couldn't say yes.
Well, there's a very good reason for that, and there's a very good reason he's sitting in Beirut and not in Baghdad. I mean, it's kind of almost, it's a running joke in Iraq, in Baghdad. The number of Iraqi government leaders who are outside the country at any one time. At one moment last year, a Baghdad newspaper calculated that every cabinet minister was outside the country. The president, Jalal Talabani, was saying a couple of months ago that most of Iraq was quiet, but you had to look where he was saying this. He was saying it in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. So you just have to get off the plane in Baghdad or look anywhere around the city to realize that this is a place in chaos and this is the most dangerous place in the world.
You talk in your piece about the number of people who have died, service members, also Iraqis, Iraqi officials. Can you go through those figures?
Yes. This is the number. If you take June last year, there were 42 American soldiers killed. So far this month, there have been 77. Last month, there were 80. There's been an assassination campaign against senior Iraqi government and religious figures, and 52 have been assassinated since the so-called handover of power a year ago. Often there seems to be chillingly accurate intelligence on the part of the killers, who know exactly where senior and important people are, and even if they have bodyguards, it's usually not enough. You have to often, when you hear or see Iraqi politicians on television or on the radio or talking abroad, it's difficult for, I think, people who don't know Iraq to realize that none of these people could get out of Baghdad if they tried, unless they had an enormous armed bodyguard. Otherwise, they'd certainly be kidnapped and almost certainly killed.
Patrick Coburn, you also talk about secret talks that are taking place between the U.S. and the resistance. What do you know?
There have been talks, but how, and it's important that these talks have been admitted, because after all, as President Bush was saying last night, this portrayal of the resistance as somehow being the same people who carried out 9/11 is wholly different from the reality on the ground. That's admitted pretty well by all these days, that there was nothing to indicate any link between Saddam Hussein and the people who planned 9/11. And despite the best efforts of investigators, nothing has emerged on this front. So I think that the... Certainly, I was rather amazed with the emphasis which the president put on this point.
We're talking to Patrick Coburn, who has been reporting from Iraq extensively, just won the 2005 Martha Gellhorn Prize for war reporting. You also talk about turning points in this last year in Iraq, two critical points, among them the capture by U.S. Marines of the rebel stronghold of Fallujah.
Yes, I think that... every so often, events like that occur that are billed as a turning point in the war. And in a way, it's got easier for the U.S. military, for Washington, to do this because, ironically, as the situation deteriorates, it becomes more and more difficult for journalists, for the media, to report properly. If I was to, let's say, go south, take the road south from Baghdad, I'd get about 20 miles before I was killed, because any Westerner will be killed on that road. The same is true of all the roads connecting Baghdad with the other provinces. So when somebody like Iyad Alawi, who you mentioned earlier, the former prime minister, stood up in Washington last year just before the election and said only 3 out of 4 Iraqi provinces, 3 out of 4 out of 18, were truly dangerous, everybody in Iraq knew this was untrue. But it's very difficult to go and prove that by the very fact that if you keep going to most of these provinces, you simply won't make it. So in a way, the atrocities committed by Zarqawi has made it much easier for the administration to pretend that no news is good news. In fact, no news out of Iraq means that something so horribly dangerous is going on that nobody can report it.
Patrick Coburn, I'd like to thank you for being with us, speaking to us recently out of Iraq. I just wrote a piece in The Independent about this year anniversary in which President Bush just spoke at Fort Bragg about the latest situation in Iraq. President Bush also directly addressed servicemen and women and their families. He told them the best way to honor those who died in the war is to keep fighting. He seemed to acknowledge the falling Army recruitment rates by putting in a plug for military service.
To the soldiers in this hall and our servicemen and women across the globe, I thank you for your courage under fire and your service to our nation. I thank our military families. The burden of war falls especially hard on you. In this war, we have lost good men and women who left our shores to defend freedom and did not live to make the journey home. I've met with families grieving the loss of loved ones who were taken from us too soon. I've been inspired by their strength in the face of such great loss. We pray for the families. And the best way to honor the lives that have been given in this struggle is to complete the mission. I thank those of you who have reenlisted in an hour when your country needs you. And to those watching tonight who are considering a military career, there is no higher calling than service in our armed forces.
President Bush speaking at Fort Bragg. In our studio in Washington, D.C., Cindy Sheehan, her son Casey, killed in Iraq in April 2004, co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you
Hi,
with us, Cindy.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Your response to President Bush addressing U.S. servicemen and women and what his message was?
Well, first of all, I think the best way to honor my son's death would be to bring the troops home. And that's what we in Gold Star Families want our children to be remembered for, peace and not war and hatred. For him to use my son's blood to continue the killing to me is despicable. I don't want one more drop of blood spilled in my son's name or in my name. We never should have been there in the first place. It was a mistake. It was a mistake when we invaded. It's a mistake now. And I want my son's sacrifice and the sacrifice of the other brave Americans to stand for peace and to bring peace to the world and not to spread more hate. You know, he said that my son died to spread freedom and democracy in that region. We're spreading imperialism and death and destruction everywhere we go. And not one more drop of blood in my son's name or the names of any other of our brave young people who have made the ultimate sacrifice for basically nothing.
Cindy, what were your feelings when your son Casey went to Iraq? Are they the same as now? And what were Casey's feelings about the invasion and occupation?
Right. Our family was against it from the beginning. Casey was against it, but he felt it was his duty to go because he was in the Army, and he felt that he had to go to protect his buddies, to be there for his buddies, to be support. And they are brainwashed into thinking that even if they don't agree with the mission, they're brainwashed into just blindly following it. I begged Casey not to go. I told him I'd take him to Canada. I told him I would run over him with a car, anything to get him not to go to that immoral war. And he said, Mom, I wish I didn't have to, but I have to go.
We're talking to Cindy Sheehan. She lost her son, Casey, in Iraq. How did Casey die? What was the mission he died on?
We were told that he was going to rescue a group of soldiers that had been ambushed on April 4th in Sadr City, Baghdad. It was when L. Paul Bremer inflamed the Shiite militia into rebellion, and first in Fallujah, then it spread to Sadr City, which is a Shiite slum in Baghdad. And so we were told he volunteered to go rescue a group of soldiers that had been ambushed. And on the way there, his convoy was ambushed, and 7 soldiers were killed in that ambush.
Cindy Sheehan, there was no mention last night at the Fort Bragg speech of the Downing Street minutes, the minutes that were taken July 23rd, 2002, before the invasion of a meeting of Prime Minister Tony Blair and his top advisors, saying that the U.S. was fixing the facts and intelligence around the policy to go to war. But you were at the hearing on the Hill in the Capitol, even if it was in the basement that was held by Congressman Conyers, of the significance of these minutes. Can you talk about that?
Well, like I said, we didn't agree with the war. We didn't agree with the invasion of Iraq. It looked like we were rushing into something that was unnecessary, you know, was not necessary to protect America. And I could see that the sanctions were working. We had years of devastating sanctions against Iraq. The UN weapon inspectors were saying there were no weapons of mass destruction. So I believed all along that this invasion was unnecessary and that there was some other agenda behind it besides keeping America safe. And when the Downing Street memos came out and I read them, I just thought, well, this confirms my suspicion that this invasion was premeditated and prefabricated for a different agenda. And it looks like my son's murder and the murder of almost 1,800 other Americans and tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis whose only crime is that they were born in Iraq at the wrong time are dead for the agenda of the neocon war machine. And I really think that somebody in our government needs to be held accountable. And just because George Bush gets up and tells us that things are getting better, they're not getting better. And he needs to present some kind of facts to back up his position. And he needs to answer the congressman. I think it's 128 congresspeople have signed John Conyers' letter asking for explanation into this Downing Street memo, and it needs to be investigated. Congress needs to do its constitutional duty for once and investigate the memo, because we families that have paid the ultimate price, who will be grieving and mourning and in pain for the rest of our lives, we deserve to know the truth.
Karen Kitowski of the Pentagon, retired lieutenant colonel. You have written about how the Pentagon has suppressed information and twisted the truth to drive the country to war. What about the Downing Street memo? Does this fit into the picture? Were you surprised by this particular meeting and the documents that have come out of that?
No, not surprised. Very much like Cindy said, it confirmed things that I witnessed that I didn't understand at the time. This intention to go to war, this decision, this very early decision, possibly as early as 2001 or before, this we were unaware of. But seeing that the decision had been made, and I think the Downing Street memoranda show that very clearly, the position of the administration long before the American people were ever notified of any kind of threat or rationale for going into Iraq. Knowing that that existed explains a whole lot of what I saw, and it makes sense. And even things that I haven't written about, things that I just saw and that folks in the Pentagon like me, probably thousands of them, saw and did not at the time understand. This war plan was engaged and operational long before many people, even insiders, understood, and it was engaged for a reason. And George Bush, in his latest speech, every time he gives a speech, in fact, I listen to see if he will explain why we are in Iraq. And every time I hear him give a speech, I'm disappointed. He never explains why we're there. He makes up stories, as he did, you know, last night's speech, very clearly untrue in many ways. And he doesn't address why our young men and women are dying. You know, it's particularly insulting to me to hear him talk about those deaths when this country and this administration has, more than any previous administration and more than any other country in the world that has lost soldiers in Iraq, has refused to show proper respect for those dead soldiers and for those losses. He has attended to date no funerals, George Bush or Dick Cheney. They refuse to acknowledge the real cost of their decisions, and this is particularly insulting for him to use their deaths and to somehow wave this flag when he himself, by his own actions, does not care about these deaths.
Karen Kutkowski is a retired lieutenant colonel speaking to us from West Virginia, worked in the Pentagon, the office that oversaw the Office of Special Plans. Douglas Feith ran that. Also in our Washington, D.C. studio, Cindy Sheehan, a mother of Casey, who is a U.S. soldier who died in Iraq last year. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Music by Fortet here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest on the line with us in Washington is Cindy Sheehan. She is the mother of Casey, who died in Iraq last year. We're also going to go to Baghdad to talk with a mother, with an Iraqi blogger about the situation there. But Cindy, I did want to ask you, right before the Fort Bragg address of President Bush, he met with family members who lost loved ones in Iraq. Have you been able to meet with Bush administration officials?
Actually, I met with the president in June of 2004, a couple months after my son was killed. We were summoned up to Fort Irwin, Washington State, to have a sit-down with the president. So my entire family went. And I was on CNN last night with Larry King talking about this. And there was another mother who had met with him, and she said that she supports the war and the president. And she said he was so warm and everything and gentle and kind. And when my family and I met with him, I met a man who had no compassion in him. He had no heart. Like Karen said, he cares nothing about us. We tried to show him pictures of Casey. He wouldn't look at them. He wouldn't even acknowledge Casey's name. He called me Mom through the entire visit. He acted like we were at a tea party, like it was something fun, that we should just be so pleased that we got to meet with the president who killed our son.
What did you say to him?
The first thing, he came up to me and he goes, "Mom, I can't imagine your loss. I can't imagine losing a loved one, you know, whether it be a mother, a father, a sister, or a brother." And I stopped him and I said, You have two children. Try to imagine them being killed in a war. How would that make you feel?" And he got a little bit of, just a little bit of human flicker in his eye, like he might be connected for a minute, because this is a man that's disconnected from humanity. And he just got a little flicker in his eye, and I said, "Trust me, you don't want to go there." And you know what he told me? He goes, "You're right, I don't. And so I said, well, thank you for putting me there. And then he moved on to the next person. And then a little while later, we were talking, and he went up to my oldest daughter, and he said, I wish I could bring back your loved one to replace the hole in your heart. And she goes, yeah, so do we. And he gave her the dirtiest look and turned his back on her and ignored her for the rest of the meeting. And then a little later on in the meeting, I said, why were we invited here? We didn't vote for you in 2000, and we're certainly not going to vote for you in 2004. And he said, it's not about politics, which is just baloney, because he went through the campaign trail, and last night he said he meets with families, and we say that we're praying for him and stuff like that. And, you know, that wasn't our experience, and everybody else I've talked to have met with him have about the same experience as I do. He comes in, says, I want to extend the gratitude of a nation and express my condolences. But he says it, and his eyes don't convey that. His heart doesn't convey that. We left our meeting with him feeling worse than when we walked in, feeling more determined to stop the madness in Iraq than before.
We're talking to Cindy Sheehan, lost her son Casey in Iraq, did meet with President Bush. Faiza Jarrar is also on the line with us. She is an Iraqi blogger who actually right now is in Amman, Jordan. Her son, Rayed, is well known for his blog, Rayed in the Middle. Faiza Jarrar, your response to the situation right now in Iraq, to the call in this country by Congress members for the president to set a timetable for withdrawal?
Yes, hello. Are you Amy?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, hello, Amy. I was in the States. I came before 2 days to Amman.
You were just visiting the United States.
Yeah, I visited the United States before. I stayed for 1 month, and then now I'm in Amman. Maybe after many days, I can go back to Baghdad, I hope. In the States, I met staff for the senators, different stuff, and I talk with them about Iraq and what is happening in Iraq since 2 years, and I discovered that they knew nothing about Iraq. And it was, for me, it was very sad, because we can see that the fate of Iraq and Iraqis now is in the hand of people who should be responsible about Iraq and Iraqi people. And I understand that nobody knows what is happening in Iraq and what is the future of Iraq. And this is very hard for Iraqi people, because, you know, my dear, every day when you see on the media all over the world, inside the state or outside the state, it is always the bombing cars and the occupation force standing away, and the President Bush giving a speech or the justification for staying in Iraq, and nobody cares about Iraqi people. Where is the Iraqi people? There are more than 25 million population. Who will go to ask them what is your attitude about this war? What is your future? What is your plan to live? What is your plan for the future of your kids? Nobody will take care about Iraqis or come to ask one of us. The media is working outside of Iraq, and this is a very dangerous situation, because like Iraq is a part of the American government, and they are dealing with it like it is their issue. It is not the Iraqi issue.
Let me ask you something, Faiza Jarrar.
Yes.
The question that is asked in the media in the United States is, if the U.S. troops were to leave, wouldn't that leave Iraqis worse off? What is your response to that?
Yeah, we talked about this issue many times. First, we are not dreamers or naive. We will not ask the troops to go out of Iraq without arranging or without fix what they have done in Iraq. Because when I came to Vermont, I studied about peace building. And then I told my participants, and I gave a presentation about Iraq, and I told all of the people that I can see now that the American government made the conflict building in Iraq. They didn't make peace building, because they divided the people between Sunni and Shia, and they kept them fighting for the power or the authority or everything, and telling the world that look for Iraqis, they can't live together. Yesterday they were sisters and brothers. You can't believe this story because we are living inside Iraq and we knew these people are our brothers and sisters. But now there is another agenda. Somebody tries to put it in Iraq. So if really the American government tried to put a time of schedule for pulling out the troops, they have to make a kind of announcement for the parties inside the government and outside the government to sit together around a table to make a kind of national agreement or national dialogue, to make a kind of agreement to start the peace operation in Iraq. After that, yes, you can say the troops can leave Iraq after 6 months or 1 year, just put to the beginning of the operation of peace in Iraq. This is the best solution, we think.
Faiza Jarar is an Iraqi blogger. She's speaking to us from Amman, heading back to Iraq from the United States, where she was visiting. Their website is afamilyinbaghdad.blogspot.com. As we turn now to another clip of President Bush from his speech last night at Fort Bragg.
Some wonder whether Iraq is a central front in the war on terror. Among the terrorists, there is no debate. Here are the words of Osama bin Laden. This Third World War is raging in Iraq. The whole world is watching this war. He says it will end in victory and glory, or misery and humiliation. The terrorists know that the outcome will leave them emboldened or defeated. So they're waging a campaign of murder and destruction. And there is no limit to the innocent lives they are willing to take. We see the nature of the enemy in terrorists who exploded car bombs along a busy shopping street in Baghdad, including one outside a mosque. We see the nature of the enemy in terrorists who sent a suicide bomber to a teaching hospital in Mosul. We see the nature of the enemy in terrorists who behead civilian hostages and broadcast their atrocities for the world to see. These are savage acts of violence, but they have not brought the terrorists any closer to achieving their strategic objectives. The terrorists, both foreign and Iraqi, failed to stop the transfer of sovereignty. They failed to break our coalition and force a mass withdrawal by our allies. They failed to incite an Iraqi civil war. They failed to prevent free elections. They failed to stop the formation of a democratic Iraqi government that represents all of Iraq's diverse population. And they failed to stop Iraqis from signing up in large number with the police forces and the army to defend their new democracy. The lesson of this experience is clear. The terrorists can kill the innocent, but they cannot stop the advance of freedom. The only way our enemies can succeed is if we forget the lessons of September the 11th, if we abandon the Iraqi people to men like Zarqawi, and if we yield the future of the Middle East to men like bin Laden. For the sake of our nation's security, this will not happen on my watch.
President Bush speaking at Fort Bragg. We are joined on the line from Austin by Rahul Mahajan. He is the author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, runs a blog called empirenotes.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!, your response to President Bush's comments.
Well, you know, in a way, there was almost nothing in them to respond to. But let me take one of the specific points that I think that there's a great deal of confusion about here. If you've been reading the news, you know that on Sunday, the Times of London reported that that some U.S. military officers are in negotiations with some insurgent or resistance factions. And one of the things that has gone, I think, less noticed and less reported is that at one point talk turned to the idea of the other factions turning over Zarqawi and some of his people or turning against them. And their response basically was, at this point, with us under attack and under occupation by the United States, we're not going to turn against any Muslim from anywhere who has come to help us fight against our enemy. Now, I personally don't think that, that Zarqawi and factions like that that are trying to incite a Sunni-Shia civil war are actually helping the Iraqis against their enemy. But it's perfectly understandable that in a situation where they are occupied and they see one of their primary problems as the presence of massive numbers of foreign fighters from the United States and Britain, that that is how they're going to see Zarqawi, that, that there's going to be an inability for the resistance to separate itself completely from small sectarian terrorist factions. There's going to be an inability for the Iraqi people to try to deal with that because it's very difficult for them to disentangle, in a sense, that these people, as you know, disentangled them as in their minds as being their allies. This is why. This is one of the reasons why, in order to bring any kind of clarity to the situation, the United States has to withdraw. If it withdraws, and part of the settlement is in fact that all Iraqi forces that will negotiate with each other, which includes the mainstream politicians now, it includes most of the resistance. It includes Muqtada al-Sadr, but it does not include Zarqawi and people like that. Then as the U.S. is withdrawing and these other factions can easily come together and negotiate and agree to deal with the terrorism problem they have. In the absence of a withdrawal, however, just the reverse dynamic happens, and more of the resistance factions feel as if Zarqawi is on their side.
Were you surprised to hear President Bush even mention bin Laden and the comments of Porter Goss, the director of Central Intelligence, saying that he knows where bin Laden is in Pakistan?
Well, I think Porter Goss's comments were you know, outright fatuity. I mean, no matter how cynical the administration may be, it's impossible to believe they actually have a clear sense of where bin Laden is, that troops know where they are, and that nobody is talking about the fact that they know where he is and they're simply not capturing him. But no, I wasn't surprised to hear Bush mention bin Laden. Bin Laden is a very convenient name for him. He totally ignored the name for years. There have been times when bin Laden is brought up, he said, oh, well, I'm not really concerned about him. But he always knew in the back of his mind that he could trot him out whenever he wanted in order to justify virtually anything he's doing. And although you know, you'd have to be insane to go to war against North Korea, if he did, he would surely be trotting bin Laden out for that as well.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, also Faiza Jarar, Iraqi blogger, speaking to us from Amman, Patrick Coburn, and Karen Kitkowski, who is the former Pentagon insider who has talked so much about what has happened there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill. Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper. Our website, democracynow.org. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.